Chapter 11, Brickbats and a Bouquet. In the Notes and News section of the August issue of the Mahabodhi Journal, there appears an item which is of more than usual interest to me. It was headed Non-Theravada Articles in the Journal, and had been written, not by me, by Dr. Narinaksha Dutt, who had joined the editorial board a few months earlier. He had written it as a result of a letter that had been received from Joseph Ailes, the editor of The Buddhist World, a fortnightly paper published in Colombo, complaining that the journal was publishing articles by Mahayana Buddhists, a practice Mr. Ailes seemed to think was not only an innovation, but contrary to everything for which the Mahabodhi Society and its journal were supposed to stand. As I was, effectively, the editor of the Mahabodhi, the letter was obviously aimed at me, and was not, in fact, the first brickbat to have been hurled in my direction by the occupants of that citadel of supposed Buddhist orthodoxy, Theravadin Ceylon. Indeed, it was not the first brickbat to have hurled in my direction by the band of militant fundamentalist Theravadins who were responsible for conducting the Buddhist world. They had been deeply upset, even outraged, by my appointment to the editorial board of what they insisted on regarding as a purely Theravadin publication, and had lost no time in attacking the appointment in the pages of their fortnightly paper, which of course meant attacking me. Joseph Ailes' letter represented a continuation of the campaign. The Buddhist world's attack on me and my appointment, which was couched in that paper's usual intemperate style, was entitled Thus Are We Misled, and was by Dhamma Mamaka, a pseudonym that concealed the identity of the wife of the founder and first editor of the paper, Major General Tan Hla Hung. This article of hers was a good example of the kind of attitude that was, and unfortunately still is, characteristic of certain representatives of the modern Theravada, as distinct from the Theravada of the Pali Canon. And as Western readers of my book, A Survey of Buddhism, as my Bangalore lectures became, and other writings of mine, may have wondered whether my portrayal of the narrowness and bigotry of these people did not contain an element of exaggeration. I reproduce here Dhamma Mamaka's article in full, together with a few comments. The article appeared in the Buddhist World of the 28th of April, 1954, and was featured on the front page. Quote, Thus Are We Misled, by Dhamma Mamaka. The Mahabodhi, Volume 62, Number 2, announces an improvement in its editorial board consequent on the appointment of a Mahayanist bhikshu, not bhikkhu, as one of its senior members, despite his, in italics, vas, V-A-S. What improvement, we are entitled to ask, could be expected from association with one having Vaitulian ideas? Is it not an insult to the memory of its revered founder and the numerous Theravadins who have supported and maintained this journal for the past 62 years to publish in its pages articles by avowedly Mahayanist contributors? It will be observed that all the four articles in this issue are by Mahayanists. Unquote. Vaitulian meant heretical, the Vaitulyavada being a quasi-Mahayanist, possibly tantric, movement in early Sinhalese Buddhism that had been forcibly suppressed by the dominant Theravada and whose name was regarded by modern Theravadins like Dhamma Mamaka as synonymous with every kind of doctrinal error and moral depravity. As for my having been appointed as one of the senior members of the Mahabodhi's editorial board, quote, despite my vas, that is, despite my vasavasa, or reigns residence, it was not clear what the writer meant by this objection. Does she mean despite the fact that, having received the higher ordination in 1950, I had observed the reigns residence only thrice, and was therefore a very junior monk? Or did she mean despite the fact that, for the duration of the reigns residence, which lasted for 3 months, a monk was not allowed to travel? In either case, her objection was beside the point. My being a junior rather than a senior monk did not disqualify me from appointment to the editorial board, any more than my having been appointed to that body in January was really incompatible with my observing the Vasavasa later in the year. Further quote from the article, thus are we misled. Quote, the columnist Himavantsavasi hides under his pseudonym the Mahayanist ideas of the editor of this journal. Four columns of his article, In the Light of the Dhamma, have been devoted for the benefit of one of his staunch supporters, who, as a, quote, sincere European Buddhist, unquote, makes the preposterous suggestion to turn the wheel of the norm backwards. He actually dares to insult, and the columnist editor apparently approves, the readers by asserting that the, quote, current Theravadin system that makes the present year 2497 is incorrect, unquote. He had even gone to the extent of insulting the Burmese, who are sparing no pains to make the Sixth Buddhist Council the great success it undoubtedly would be. Unquote. The sincere European Buddhist happened to be G.F. Allen, ex-bhikshu Y. Sri Jnana, the scholarly author of the book The Buddha's Philosophy. He was not a supporter of mine, staunch or otherwise, but simply a regular reader of the Mahabodhi, who had written to me in my editorial capacity. His so-called preposterous suggestion, which, according to Dhammamamaka, amounted to a turning of the wheel of the norm backwards, related to the chronology of the Pali Canon. Inasmuch as such traditional stories as that in which the Lord Buddha is said to have taught Abhidharma to his departed mother in Tushita heaven and returned to earth to expound it to mankind, and that the Tipitaka was rehearsed at the first council held a few months after the Parinibbana, were not fact but legend, and inasmuch as there was in existence a copious library of scholastic research into the chronology of the Pali Canon, contributed over the last half century by the finest scholars of Buddhism of both the East and the West, did not the approaching Sixth Council offer an admirable opportunity for the best brains of the Buddhist world to face that vitally important subject in a rational and scientific manner, and work out an acceptable, detailed chronology of the three Pitakas? My well-meaning correspondent, who was himself a liberal Theravadin, ventured to offer two further suggestions for the Council's agenda. One, that a uniform system of referencing the Pali canonical quotations be introduced, and that the Council agree upon a chronology of dates for the Buddhist era, the current system that made the year 2497 being incorrect. Why this last suggestion should be regarded as an insult to the readers of the Mahabodhi was unclear, unless the Buddhist world's fiery contributor was under the impression that the journal's readership was made up entirely of Orthodox Theravadins, and unless she believed, likewise, that the Theravada was incapable of being mistaken in its chronology. It was also unclear in what the insult to the Burmese consisted. In fact, it was unclear whether it was the sincere European Buddhist who had insulted them, or his friend, the columnist editor, the writer's rage apparently having affected her ability to write coherently. But probably it was the columnist editor. Earlier in the year, I had upset some of the more conservative Burmese Theravadins by pointing out that the Burmese pronunciation of Pali was incorrect, as well as by suggesting, in an editorial, that the money being spent on building new shrines and gilding old ones should be devoted instead to propagating the teachings of the Buddha. For the latter offence, the Australian-born editor of The Light of the Dhamma, the official organ of the Union of Burma Buddha Sasana Council, threatened me with rebirth as a dwarf, while the Buddhist world attacked me on both counts in the most vitriolic terms. To these attacks, I responded with two light-hearted squibs in my Himavantsavasi column, and, more seriously, with an editorial on controversy, in which, after referring to the Buddha's warning against wordy warfare, I quoted at length from Addison's Spectator essay entitled Modes of Disputing. The Buddhist world, I observed, had discovered a mode of disputing unknown to Addison, which we might call arguing by abuse. quote from the article, "Whoever disagrees with its narrow, dogmatic and intolerant views is at once attacked in the vilest and most virulent language. Heretic, pseudo-Buddhist and Devadatta are among the milder epithets with which it favours anyone whose ideas do not coincide in every particular with its own. The leading Buddhist layman of Ceylon, who has done more for the revival of Buddhism than any other Sinhalese since Anagarika Dhammapala, who, by the way, had to face similar attacks even on his deathbed, is assailed with accusations so wild and abuse so gross that one wonders how the paper concerned can venture to describe itself as Buddhist. Of course, it is not difficult for ill nature to disguise itself as zeal for religion, or dogmatism to pose as sadhā. In fact, the paper's official description of its mud-slinging policy is, quote, radiating metta." But regardless of whether my response to their attacks was light-hearted or serious, it saddens me that I should be the object of abuse by fellow Buddhists. When I confided my feelings to Anandji, however, my cynical and worldly-minded elder brother in the order only laughed. "Well, if they want to make you famous, why should you worry?" he wanted to know. But I preferred not to be made famous by such means. Further quote from Thus Are We Misled by Dhammamamaka. Quote, "The sincere European Buddhist has asked his friend, the columnist editor, to, quote, see your way to making the suggestion in the columns of the Mahabodhi Journal, that is the premier and eldest mouthpiece of, in italics, our, the italics are ours, Buddhist world, provided, of course, that you agree as to its importance. It might bear fruit. We understand the agreement between these two friends. That is why so much space has been allowed in this journal. It will certainly bear fruit. The rotten fruit which should never have found a place in this journal. We would ask Himavantsavasi to disclose the name of his friend, the sincere European Buddhist, or is he ashamed or afraid to divulge it? Himavantsavasi and people of his ilk would do well to bear in mind that the Mahabodhi is a purely Theravada publication, supported and maintained by Theravadins all these long years, that anti-Theravadin views should not be allowed to sully its pages." Unquote. I did not disclose the name of my alleged friend, the sincere European Buddhist, as I did not wish to embroil him in my own disagreements with the Buddhist world. Had I disclosed it, Dhammamamaka might well have received a shock. G.F. Allen, having spent several years in India and Ceylon as a monk, and been highly regarded in Theravadin circles. His reference to our Buddhist world, to which Dhammamamaka took such exception, was simply an innocent acknowledgement of the fact that all Buddhists were members of a single ecumene. It did not represent a laying claim to the Buddhist world on behalf of the Mahayanists, as Dhammamamaka seems to have thought. Was a Theravadin organization and its journal a purely Theravadin publication, was the principal point addressed in Dr. Dutt's notes and news item on non-Theravada articles in the journal, as shortly will transpire. Quote from Dr. Dutt's article. Quote, "It would, perhaps, interest readers to know what the editor of The Western Buddhist says about Mahabodhi. Here it is. We value highly the encouragement given by many Buddhist periodicals, especially the most friendly welcome accorded us in the pages of Mahabodhi at the pen of the Venerable Himavantsavasi. We should do our utmost to justify the welcome support of the Venerable Bhikkhu and to fulfil the prophecies he makes about us. The Venerable Bhikkhu is also a preacher of the Western Order." The Western Buddhist was the organ of the Western Buddhist Order, founded about 2 years earlier by Robert Stuart Clifton, an American Buddhist, and its editor was Jack Austin, the young English bank clerk who was one of my most faithful correspondents. Though I did not agree with all Clifton's ideas and had not been too pleased at my involuntary co-option into his order, I had, as Himavantavasi, indeed given the order's little journal a warm welcome on its first appearance. Dhamma Mamaka evidently thought that this fact would interest her readers as constituting further evidence, if such were needed, of my Mahayana proclivities, the Western Buddhist order being admittedly based on the far eastern Mahayana Sangha of Japan, for which, and other shortcomings, it had already been more than once castigated in the pages of the Buddhist world. She concluded her article by recurring to the theme that it was an insult to the memory of Anagarika Dhammapala that Mahayanists should be allowed to control the Mahabodhi. Further quote from Thus Are We Misled by Dhamma Mamaka. The Mahabodhi Society of India must realise that it is an insult to the memory of its revered founder and its numerous supporters in all parts of the Theravada world to allow Mahayanists to control this valued journal, and that the sooner they can get the Rakshita to change his spots, the better it would be, if its continuance is to be ensured for many, many years to come. This is the earnest wish of Theravadins. Otherwise its knell would be sounded sooner or later, sooner perhaps than later. If this were to happen, it would indeed be a tragedy, and a success for the bhikshu. End of quote. I did not change my spots, or at least did not change them in the way Dhamma Mamaka had in mind, and continued to edit the Mahabodhi journal, and Pacey, her despicable suggestion that I was out to destroy it, managed to ensure its continuance as the leading English-language Buddhist journal until my final return to the West 12 years later. The history of the Mahabodhi journal thereafter was one of steady decline. With Mahayanists no longer in control, its knell indeed sounded, and eventually it ceased publication. But in 1954, all that was in the distant future. Though the August notes and news sections item on non-Theravada articles in the journal had been written as a result of Joseph Ayles' letter, it in fact made no mention of that letter. Instead, it took issue with Dhamma Mamaka's article in the Buddhist World. The truth of the matter was that the nature of Ayles' letter had at first been seriously misunderstood, and the action which, as I discovered on my return to Calcutta from Nagpur, had been taken by the editorial board in order to restrict me in my work for the journal, had been taken on the basis of the misunderstanding. The letter had been received, apparently, by Sila Bhadra. At any rate, it was Sila Bhadra who had placed it before a meeting of the governing body, and Sila Bhadra who had informed the meeting that it was a complaint about the editorials that had been appearing in the Society's journal, editorials which were, as was well known, written by me. The result was that without those present having actually read the letter for themselves, a resolution was passed upholding Ayles' complaint and, by implication, criticising me for writing the editorials. Armed with this resolution, Sila Bhadra was able to persuade the editorial board to pass a resolution of its own, restricting me in my work for the journal and making me, in effect, a tool in the hands of himself and the other members of the board. But Joseph Ayles' letter did not so much as mention my editorials, as I ascertained from a perusal of the minutes of the governing body's meeting, to which a copy of the letter was attached. His complaint was that the Mahabodhi Journal was publishing articles by Mahayana Buddhists, so that the resolution passed by the governing body was entirely beside the point. I therefore went to see Keshub Chandra Gupta, one of the vice presidents of the society, under whose chairmanship the governing body meeting at which this resolution was passed had been held. Keshub Babu was a tall, dark-complexioned, saturnine Bengali in late middle age, whom I had seen a few times at society functions, but with whom I was personally unacquainted. Besides being a prominent member of the Calcutta Bar, he was connected with several educational institutions and was a regular contributor to leading Indian dailies and monthlies, both English and Bengali. He was, of course, a Hindu, though not a Brahmin, and I was not sure how sympathetic a hearing he would give to my representations, it being well known that I was no less critical of Orthodox Hinduism than I was of fundamentalist Theravada. I need not have worried. As I proceeded with my story, Keshub Babu's heavy eyebrows elevated themselves in astonishment, and he listened with increasing interest. The governing body had not understood the nature of Mr. Ailes' letter, I explained, nor grasped its implications. Mr. Ailes had not complained about my editorials, as Seelabhadra had led it to believe. His complaint was that the Mahabodhi Journal was publishing articles by Mahayana Buddhists, which he seemed to regard as an innovation. The point to be decided by the governing body was, therefore, whether articles by Mahayanists or contributions dealing with Mahayana Buddhism were to be excluded from the journal or not. In deciding this point, it would have to bear in mind that neither the society nor its journal were limited to any sect of Buddhism. Both were international and intersectarian. Many members of the society, including the president, were Mahayanists. It would also have to bear in mind that articles by Mahayanists and articles dealing with Mahayana Buddhism had appeared in the journal ever since its inception. The founder himself had written several appreciative articles on Mahayana Buddhism, including one in the first issue of the journal in May 1892. And we were certainly not being unfaithful to his memory by continuing the practice of publishing such articles. The governing body might also like to take note of the fact, of which it had evidently been unaware, though Seelabhadra had been well aware of it, that Mr. Ailes happened to be the editor of The Buddhist World, a fortnightly paper published from Colombo that was well known for the violence and virulence of its attacks on Mahayana Buddhism. In view of these considerations, I concluded, the governing body should pass a fresh resolution to the effect that a reply be sent to Mr. Ailes, preferably over the signature of himself as chairman of the meeting, informing him that the society and its journal were not limited to any sect of Buddhism, and that as the journal had published articles on Mahayana Buddhism, including some by the founder himself from the very beginning, his complaint on this score could not be entertained. Experienced criminal lawyer that he was, it was not difficult for Keshub Babu to see the force of my arguments. Neither was it difficult for him to see that Seelabhadra had acted in a less than straightforward manner. He therefore told me that he agreed with me on all points, and that if I would write to him officially, he would raise the matter at the next meeting of the governing body. Business thus having been dispatched to our mutual satisfaction, we turned to other topics, and spent the rest of the evening discussing Buddhism and literature. My next step was to have the decisions that the editorial board had taken in my absence rescinded. This I did at the special meeting of the board that I had asked Jenaratna to convene, though I did not manage to do it without coming into violent conflict with Seelabhadra, who seemed determined that the decisions should not be rescinded, and who seemed, in fact, to share Joseph Ailes and Dhammamamaka's conviction that the Mahabodhi Journal was a purely Theravadin publication. In the course of our rather heated exchange, I confronted him with the deception he had practised on the governing body, as well as on the editorial board itself, and took him severely to task for his treacherous and underhand behaviour. My language was rather strong, perhaps stronger than it should have been to such an old man. Seelabhadra was more than twice my age, and was to die the following year. But I was outraged that one who did so little for the journal should seek to obstruct my own efforts on its behalf, and exasperated, moreover, by the obstinacy with which he continued to maintain his position, even when it had been shown to be without foundation. The result of my meeting with Keshub Chandragupta and of my having the editorial board's decisions rescinded was that I was able to leave Calcutta for Kalimpong, secure in the knowledge that I was still the de facto editor of the journal, and free to operate without the restrictions Sila Bhadra had sought to impose on me. A few days after my return, Sachin brought me, along with the rest of the mail, my copies of the August issue of the Mahabodhi, in which there appeared, as the second item in the notes and news section, Dr. Dutt's non-Theravada articles in the journal. My scholarly colleague did not express himself as forcibly as I might have done, but he expressed himself forcibly enough, his contribution being, in fact, based upon an editorial on our policy that I had sent Keshu Babu, along with the official letter for which he had asked, but which had not been used. Moreover, though he had given me only lukewarm support at the special meeting of the editorial board, soft-spoken, bespectacled Dr. Dutt was, I knew, very much of my own way of thinking with regard to the Mahabodhi Journal. When I saw him in his room at the university, where he was the head of the Department of Pali, the day after the meeting, he indeed went so far as to characterise Sila Bhadra's attitude as narrow-minded and bigoted. Thus, it did not surprise me that, although the item of which he was author should have been more forcibly written, he should have struck, in the opening paragraph, a sufficiently stern and decisive note. A recent pseudonymous article published in the Buddhist World, 28th of April 1954, of Colombo, he declared, had dragged in the name of the society's founder, Anagarika Dhammapala, without giving sufficient thought to the magnanimity of his outlook expressed in the early issues of the Mahabodhi Journal in these words. Quote, "The society, representing Buddhism in general, not only single aspects of it, shall preserve absolute neutrality with respect to the doctrines and dogmas taught by sections and sects among the Buddhists. It is not lawful for anybody, whether a member or not, to attempt to make it responsible as a body for his own views. Membership being open to all, whether professed Buddhists or not, the society is bound to guarantee them their rights as neutrals. It will be equally ready to publish expositions of all Buddhist sects, but without committing itself to any one." Dhammapala's outlook had indeed been a magnanimous one, as I well knew, from having written about the Anagarika's life 2 years earlier, and the noble statesman cited by Dr. Dutt served to make it clear, once and for all, whether or not the society and its journal were the exclusive property of the Theravadins. Dr. Dutt also drew attention to the fact that the writer of Thus Are We Misled had even shut his or her eyes to the cover of the journal, in which it was clearly stated that the Mahabodhi is a monthly journal of international Buddhist Brotherhood. He then proceeded to show that out of the four articles complained of as being by Mahayanists, three established nothing but Theravadin points of view, while the fourth paper was a descriptive one giving information about later Buddhism, which the editors considered should be made known to the Theravadin Buddhists. As regards the particular exception that had been taken to the remarks of a sincere European Buddhist, who had attached more value to the results of critical scholarship than to orthodox beliefs, such views admittedly might not appeal to all Buddhists, but there were Ceylonese scholars like Professor Malalasekera and others who adhered to the former views. Dr. Dutt was evidently unaware that, along with Christmas Humphreys, Robert Stuart Clifton and me, G.P. Malalasekera was one of the Buddhist world's principal bete noirs, and that it was constantly attacking him. Finally, though probably upset by the names of the contributors, the writer of Thus Are We Misled should, on the contrary, have appreciated that so many foreigners had been attracted to Buddhism and had studied the Pali texts in order to find out what Buddhism really was. Thus, my scholarly colleague, though disappointed that my editorial on our policy had not been used, I could see that it was better that Dhammamamaka's allegations should be refuted in the notes and news section of the journal rather than in an editorial which would have given the Buddhist world more importance than it deserved. In any case, my policy of printing articles by Buddhists of all persuasions had been amply vindicated, and the brickbats hurled at me from Theravada in Ceylon had fallen short of their mark. But if brickbats were sometimes hurled in my direction, I was also the recipient of the occasional bouquet. Not long after my return to Kalimpong, there arrived at the Hermitage a copy of the Mysorean, self-described as a national weekly with an international outlook. It contained an article by M. A. Venkata Rao, a literary member of the Indian Institute of Culture, to whom, on my departure from Bangalore, I had presented a complete set of stepping stones. Clearly, the gift had not been wasted. The article, which was entitled Poison But Also Nectar, bore the subtitle When East Meets West, the Fruit is Sometimes of Uncommon Value. And it was about me. Bhikshu Sangharakshita's lectures at the Indian Institute of Culture that year had shown him as a scholarly student of Buddhist lore with a remarkable gift for clear and attractive exposition, the writer was so good as to declare. But the puzzle remained as to why this attraction towards ancient Buddhist teachings should have led a young Britisher to burn his boats and become a bhikshu. Were not specialisation, assimilation, and even exposition possible without accepting sannyas and formal monasticism and binding oneself to the limitations of historical dogmatical schools? Whatever the answer to that question, a glimpse into the discourses and poems contained in the 20 numbers of Stepping Stones revealed, in the writer's opinion, a singularly attractive personality. One gets the impression that here we have one of the romances of the inner life of our times. Though the meeting of East and West had generated much poison, it had also brought forth nectar, as in the Puranic story of the churning of the ocean by gods and asuras, the nectar of immortality. Not that the bhikshu's case was unique. A whole series of earnest and inspired Westerners, touched by something deep and unfathomable in Eastern tradition, had devoted themselves, heart and soul, to the service of the Asian peoples. Such in India had been Sister Nivedita, C.F. Andrews and Mirabin, and such now were Sri Krishna Prem and Father Verrier Elwin. What then made this British youngster come to India at the early age of 19, at the height of the War of World Powers, 1944, casting out the pride of race and empire? And what sustained his resolve and carried him into the fold of Buddhist monasticism in this age of secularism? Venkata Rao thought stepping stones revealed much of the answer. Quote, "The young bhikshu, he is now 29, is a poet and has a genuinely aesthetic temperament. His discourses and poems show a perfect and attractive fusion of poetic and spiritual strains. The appeal of beauty in life and nature overflows naturally into the sense of the transcendental. We find here a variant of the new kind of priest, preacher, or interpreter of spiritual things, of which there is a great need everywhere. For the bhikshu has approached the Buddhist scriptures not as an orientalist or unattached scholar, but as a thirsty soul seeking the water of everlasting life. And the little magazine is full of the appealing result." End of quote. Though I had certainly not achieved a perfect fusion of the poetic and spiritual strains of my own nature, I could appreciate that there was a need for a new kind of priest, preacher, or interpreter of spiritual things, and it was interesting that my Bangalore friend should see me as a variant of such a figure. Lama Govinda, I knew, believed that religion and poetry, indeed religion and all forms of art, were closely connected. In his introduction to The Veil of Stars, my little, as yet unpublished, volume of poetic aphorisms, he had expressed his belief that It was the poet in Sangharakshita that led him to the religious life, and it was the path of renunciation that enabled him to see the world in a wider and truer perspective, which is the hallmark of genuine poetry. He had also gone on to quote the words of Novalis: "Poets and priests were one in the beginning, and only later times have separated them. The real poet, however, has always remained priest, just as the real priest has always remained poet." In my essay, The Religion of Art, written the previous year, I had affirmed my belief that art and religion overlapped, and that just as there was in religion a constituent that was aesthetic, so there was also in art a constituent that was religious. The essay indeed concluded with the declaration that the religion of art, as I called it, was peculiarly fitted to produce a kind of character, a type of spiritual personality, which would be the living embodiment of the fact that religion and art were in essence one, and that beauty was not merely truth, but goodness as well. Not that I thought of my own character or personality as constituting such an embodiment. I still saw myself simply as a monk who wrote poetry, even though there were moments when aesthetic experience and spiritual experience seemed to coincide. Perhaps I needed to redefine my identity. Be that as it may, having given a thumbnail sketch of the young bhikshu's temperament, Venkata Rao turned to Kalimpong, the place where he had settled, which he described at some length and in the most grandiloquent terms. "Situated on a foothill of the Himalayan range, within sight of Kanchenjunga Peak, which bore an unearthly purity and splendour when the clouds lifted, with the deep and narrow river flowing and turning upon itself, skirting deep gorges between hills, covered with evergreen forests of sal and deodar, hills whose tops dotted the horizon all round, leading up on the north to the ice-clad Himalayan peaks in mid-sky, as it were, with houses peeping through the foliage round the slopes of the hills at all levels, and the central road becoming the market road at the 10th mile. Kalimpong was a dream of restful and various beauty, wrapped in translucent, lambent radiance all its own. Beyond the Himalayas lay the mysterious land of Buddhist Tibet, fabled still to contain teachers of primeval wisdom." From Tibet, via one of my poems, it was not difficult for the writer to make the transition to reincarnation and karma, and from these to some of the topics with which I had dealt in my discourses, as he called my articles, from the stepping stones of right conduct, meditation and wisdom, to the Bodhisattva ideal, and from the simple life to the nature of Buddhahood. Unfortunately, Venkata Rao's appreciation of my having worked out for myself, quote, "an appealing form of Mahayana Buddhism, through which a positive spiritual idealism gleams forth, not in technicalities, but in terms of thought and feeling, while seeking out the higher values of life," unquote, was vitiated for me by his typically Hindu insistence on seeing this as constituting a return by an alternative route to Upanishadic idealism. Nonetheless, I was pleased with the article. It really was a bouquet, even if among the flowers there was a weed or two. I particularly appreciated the writer's pointing out the way in which the sights and sounds of Kalimpong, besides forming a natural background to my thoughts, provided much of the symbolism and imagery of the discourses and poems. And of course I appreciated his quoting from three of my poems, even if his attribution to messengers from Tibet of a, quote, "certain eerie lilt recalling Yeats and Walter de la Mare," unquote, rather puzzled me. My poems were very much on my mind at the time. 45 of them, most of which had been contributed originally to various magazines, had recently been brought out by a Bombay publishing house under the title Messengers from Tibet and Other Poems, and notices had already begun to appear. The Illustrated Weekly of India, in an unsigned review that was probably by the English-born editor Mr. Mandy, characterised this, my first publication in book form, as, quote, "a pleasant volume, mainly religious and descriptive in tone." unquote. The idiom was conservative and the rhythm mellifluent. There was no great depth of thought behind the imagery, which was purely factual for the most part, as for example in Mountain Mist, from which the reviewer proceeded to quote, "A poet of gentle sentiments and wistful longings, Bhikshu Sangrachita consistently employs straight rhymes of a studiously correct and simple nature, and one feels that had he resorted occasionally to well-contrived assonance, the result would have been more effective. I was at best, the reviewer thought, in my shorter lyrics, some of which had a strong flavour of the work of Walter de la Mare." Miss I. B. Horner, the distinguished translator of the Vinaya Pitaka, reviewing the collection in the Mahabodhi, concentrated on the fact that the author of these, quote, charming and happy poems, unquote, as she called them, was deeply in the debt and under the spell of India, that great and beautiful land, with her kindliness, patience, and age-old wisdom, the birthplace of the Lord of Compassion, that, quote, void-born compassion, diamond-hard and petal-tender, unquote, to which I appealed in the poem Invocation. Several of the poems, she pointed out, had India, with her snowy mountains, her rivers, plains and villages, her flowers, her sunshine, mists and rain, as the fount and as the symbols of man's adventures as he strives and aspires to fulfil the spiritual growth for which the teaching of the Buddha provides a way, a track of sunward mounting golden stages. She also drew attention to the fact that the poems were happy because their inspiration stemmed from Buddhism, and in Buddhism there was nothing sad, dismal, or depressing. Having a book published, it has been said, is one of the all-time most satisfying experiences. A good part of the satisfaction lies in presenting copies to one's friends. One of the first recipients of Messengers from Tibet was Claire Cameron, the pixie-like former editor of the Buddhist Society's journal The Middle Way. The volume was in fact dedicated to her. 10 years earlier, I had shown her the best of my youthful verses, and she had given me, in the course of a walk in Kensington Gardens, the benefit of some very sound criticism, for which I was still grateful. Recipients of the volume nearer home included Sachin, Dawa, the Anagarika, Joe, and of course Dr. Hudson, still settled comfortably in Darjeeling, who had defrayed the cost of publication. When I handed Joe his copy, the hypercritical Upasaka could not forbear heaving a small brickbat of his own in my direction, glaring through his spectacles at the cream-coloured little volume as though it was something that the cat had brought him. He professed himself extremely disappointed. Why, for the generous sum Dr. Hudson had given me, he had expected to see a handsome deluxe edition, printed on the best handmade paper, lavishly illustrated by a well-known Bombay artist, and with beautifully designed end papers and a watered silk marker. But there it was. I had done things in my own way, as I always did. I had not consulted anybody, least of all him, with the result that the publisher had swindled me and Dr. Hudson's money had been wasted. Joe's outburst momentarily confounded me. Dr. Hudson had given me 750 rupees, this being what the publishers had asked for bringing out my poems, and from what I knew of printing and binding costs in Calcutta, their demand was not unreasonable. Nonetheless, I was sufficiently disturbed to write to Sophia Wadia, in whose Aryan Path a brief notice of Messengers from Tibet had appeared, asking her if she thought I'd been swindled. Her reply was unequivocal. 750 rupees was not a great deal of money, and I could rest assured that the book had been produced to as high a standard as could be expected for that sum. Joe remained unconvinced, and not only refused to retract his brickbat, but that before long was assuring Dr. Hudson that it was useless for anyone to give me money, as I was totally impractical and always wasted it. Brickbats and bouquets were, it seems, an integral part of mundane existence. Sometimes they were more of the former, sometimes more of the latter, but one never experienced the one without, sooner or later, experiencing the other. The wisest course was to treat them as one should, according to Kipling's famous poem, treat those two impostors, triumph and disaster, that is, just the same. Or else be, in the words of the Mangala Sutta, one of those whose mind does not shake when touched by the eight worldly conditions of pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and infamy. Not that the wisest course was necessarily the easiest, especially to someone as sensitive as I was to people's emotional reactions to me, and as liable, moreover, to fluctuations of mood, fluctuations which, more often than not, found expression only in my poetry. Nevertheless, conscious of the need to develop equanimity, I did my best to be neither cast down by Dhammamamaka's and Joe's brickbats, nor elated by Venkata Rao's bouquet, and carried on with my work for Buddhism and the local people. As usual, this included the giving of a good deal of personal tuition. After my return to Kalimpong, I had resumed teaching Sachin and Mira, the latter at her home, whenever I happened to be visiting there, and had started teaching Durga, Sachin's 16-year-old cousin, history and English literature. Sweet-natured, but inclined to be taciturn, Durga lived near Sixth Mile, and in the evening, after giving him his lessons, I sometimes walked a mile or two down the road with him, instead of going up the road to Sachin's place. I also started teaching the Anigarika, or Thubden Chokil, as she now was, having been ordained as a Shramaneri, or novice nun, by Dada Rinpoche that summer. In her case, the lessons were meant to serve the double purpose of helping her improve her English and deepen her knowledge of Buddhism, not to mention satisfying her chronic need for attention. But they did not continue for long, as after a few weeks, the ever-restless French woman decided that she would be better off back in Darjeeling. I was not sorry to see her go, for though intellectually stimulating, she was extremely demanding and had taken to complaining about the Rinpoche's supposed lack of interest in her in a way I did not like. Besides, I had not forgotten B.P. Wadia's request that I should write out my Bangalore lectures for publication in book form and wanted to set to work as soon as possible. This was not proving easy to arrange. Not that giving tuition was the only thing that took up my time. There were meetings to be organised, letters to be written, usually I wrote several a day, visitors to be received, as well as the Mahabodhi Journal to be edited. Eventually, however, on the last day of August, I seated myself at the rickety, gate-legged table that served me as a desk, spread out my lecture notes and started writing. Quote, "The importance of right motive, of a correct attitude of mind, is emphasized more strongly in Buddhism than in any other form of traditional teaching," I wrote. Work on the first chapter of A Survey of Buddhism had begun. 2 hours later, having filled several foolscap sheets, I put down my pen and walked out into the garden. Despite the rain, the sun was shining brilliantly. Looking up into the sky, I saw a rainbow. According to Tibetan Buddhist belief, the appearance of a rainbow was an auspicious sign. Double and triple rainbows had spanned my path when, almost exactly 7 years ago, I had gone forth from home into the homeless life. This was a single rainbow. Nonetheless, I hoped its appearance was auspicious, and that, now I had started writing the survey, I would be able to get on with the work without too many interruptions. End of chapter 11.